Al. Welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham, and we're hiding the matches in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last week we huffed and we puffed, but we couldn't blow Villa's house down, mostly thanks to an outstanding display from Emi Martinez, who saw to it that Dean Smith's side returned to Birmingham with a point. Whether Jack Grealish managed to get out of Joel Veltman's pocket in time to get on the bus has yet to be confirmed. We now have a small matter of a visit from that lot up the road on Monday. Palace's form has been patchy of late, but they will be keen to avoid a defeat that would see us leapfrog them and further incense a section of their fan base who have written an open letter to this week criticising the club's ambition. It's also worth noting that the corresponding fixture this time last year was the last time that the Amex was full. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to be joined by a man who had a foot in both camps. He had a five-year playing career with the Glass Smashers, playing 69 times before linking up with the Good Guys in 1987 as assistant to Barry Lloyd. There began a long association with the Albion and was put in caretaker charge a few times before giving the top job in 2002. He's also the man that brought Lewis Dunk to the club. He was once described by Dick Knight as not a big name, just a long one. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Martin Hinshelwood. Martin, thank you so much for joining us on The Roar. It's lovely to see you safe and well.
Pleasure. Thank you, Andy. And Adam, thank you for inviting me on.
Not at all. How are you, mate? How's the lockdown? But we have to ask this of everyone. But how's lockdown been for you and in the current job that it is you do?
It's driving me mad, I've got to say. At the moment, I do some coaching at Lancing College, but we're all furloughed there. And just before the season started, I was at Stoke, and they decided to change their tactics of how they were going to do their scouting, etc. So we were all made redundant. So I've worked for a couple of clubs doing some scouting different games, but at the moment it's difficult to get a full-time or part-time job because of the situation we're all in.
Sure. So in that case, I mean, you know, with the vaccines being rolled out and, you know, eventually, hopefully, you know, before long, at least half the country would have been jabbed, then, you know, can you see light at the end of the tunnel? Is this what the football clubs are saying, do you know?
Yeah, I think they can. You know, it's difficult at the moment for you know, probably the non-league, even the lower leagues, you know, the finances of everything, the people not going from the turnstiles. Mm. And even like Brighton and Palace, they're finding it hard as well. So the sooner we can get people into the stadiums, it's going to be great for everybody.
Yeah, and we also just got the news this week that your nephew Adam's going to have to wait for another season for promotion, as that season's now been declared null and void for Worthing.
Yeah, I saw that. And I see that one or two clubs will complain. You know, example, I saw today, is it Dorking Wanderers?
Mm.
You know, they're top of the Conference South, and I think they're going to write against it because, you know, they've put a lot of money into that club over the last couple of seasons.
Well, as I understand it, it's the National League that has voted to continue, I believe. But I think it's Conference, or as we would call it, Conference North and South. I mean, we always go by its old names, but I think it's National League North and South. I'm not sure, AD, I mean, perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not sure that they've voted as far down as the level that Worthing are at, which I think at the moment is Tier 7.
I'm not sure whether they got voted or not, but basically the decision was made and the season's been declared null and void.
Well,
so
the FA have still got to ratify it, although it's expected to be a box ticking thing. But I think Martin was on the money there. Dorking Wanderers, I think their attitude was along the lines of, well, those who don't want to carry on or can't carry on, then just drop out and come back, you know, the following year. But there are some of them who still can carry on. And it's that level that you realise that, you know, that where the furloughs and where the COVID has bitten the hardest. You know, it's not a League Two necessarily who've cut their cloth accordingly, or even League One. It's the National League. It's Tier 5 and 6. And Martin, like you say, you've spent time, you know, at those levels. It's not just that the football club itself, it's the community that suffers, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, I live in Selsey, a small village, but, you know, they're playing the County League, but the number of people I know go up there and just miss going up there to watch football and socialise, as well as watching the games and watching the the big boys on the telly as well.
Yeah, I mean that's it. I mean, that's a conversation we've been having a lot on this show about. I mean, you know, it's part of a ritual, isn't it? You know, I mean, when we're not going to the Albion, we go and watch Worthing, and we know people that go and watch non-league football all over the place. Not just.
Well, you say we watch Worthing. What we actually normally do is just sit there and bait the opposition, or stand there with our beers, because you can do that drinking beer on the. On the side of the thing. I mean, we are probably the biggest advertisements for football, not for beers not returning from football territory. Because
we're not rude
as such. We're okay. Just naughty. But actually, can I just quickly mention something? It was a story that happened 10 days ago, which we didn't touch on, but I do want to say well done to, is it does appear that Southwick Football Club are going to be going home sooner rather than later, probably in time for the new season. The Russell Martin Foundation has been given approval to operate at Old Barn Way. I think that they're going to be doing the place up, and Southwick are effectively a kind of a subtenant there, so they can now recontinue. They can continue their history at Old Barn Way. So well done to everyone involved in that, especially Terry Kyber and Anatella and all those who have used the grassroots connections for that town to you know, get their team back at where they should be.
That's great news. Russell Martin, was he a player that came through you?
He was at Basvik.
Yeah.
And we invited him in for a trial. And he came in and I think it was about 2 months he was in for. And to be fair to him, he's a lovely lad. And he was playing games and that. But he came and spoke to us and said, look, I don't deserve to be playing at the moment. I'm probably not up to the level you want. And I'm going to go back to college. And I really admire his admission that at that time he was finding it difficult to settle in and look forward to having a pro career.
Did you agree with his analysis?
At that time he just felt we were playing him because we had invited him in. We would never have done that if he didn't deserve to be in the side. We would never have played him. But he was an honest lad that felt that at the time he wasn't ready for it, and went back to Basvik. And after that, you know, he's had a great career, and now he's starting his managerial career, and also got the academy going in Brighton.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Hey, do you want one of those weird stats now?
Go on.
Of all professional footballers born in Brighton, more have played for Scotland than have played for England. They've played more times for Scotland than have played for England. And that's basically down to Russell Martin.
I was going to say it's down to Martin Hinshelwood because of Virg's played for Scotland as well. But
Virg's played for Scotland five times. I think two or three times, was it? I don't think he did. He play for the first team?
No, he played for their B team. But we're going to come back and talk about the players that you've had a hand in developing a little bit later on. But let's start with the game last week. We were at home to Aston Villa, of course, and we thrashed them 0-0. Martin, when you watch a display like that, from a coaching perspective, what can you do about the finishing? Because, I mean, how much of it can you put down to good goalkeeping? And how much of it can you put down to just bad luck? Because surely there's an area of the goal where the goalkeeper can't get it.
Yeah, but sometimes in things happen so quickly. You know, in 2013, his reactions on a couple of saves were outstanding. But I would think that the boys who missed the chances for Brighton would have been disappointed, because during the week, they probably would have scored 99 times out of 100. It's just at the moment, it's just that they're getting into great areas. And the one thing you always say that they've got to be in those areas to miss them. If they're not in those areas, then you've got a major problem. But the players, even though they're missing the chances, they're getting the areas where they should be. And I think only time will come where they'll start in the back of the net.
So with that in mind then, so, I mean, what kind of drills would they be doing in training? Because, I mean, it's like, I mean, this is, we've been basically...
You're convinced they don't practice, aren't you?
Well, no, I am convinced they do. No, of course they practice. But, I mean, you know, we've been doing match reports, which has basically been cut and paste for the last few months.
Because
we're absolutely murdering sides. And we're just that one piece of the jigsaw away from being... champions of Europe, the world.
Well, steady on.
Steady, come on.
I'm ambitious.
Yeah. Champions are Sussex first. No, I mean, what does someone as a coach, as someone in charge of training, of tactics, of the whole thing, the coaching sort of, you know, sort of side of things, when, like you say, in training, in Lancing, they're banging them in 99 times out of 100. Sanchez is getting fed up. Steele's getting fed up because everything's going past them into the net. Come match day, which is the time that really matters, they fluff their lines. What does a manager, how can a manager remedy that?
It's difficult. You can always, all you can do is keep encouraging them. Keep encouraging that they're good players, the opportunities will come. And, you know, they would do sessions during the week. And 9 times out of 10 during the week as well, you'll get the strikers, when they finish the sessions, doing extra. Yeah. I can remember, you know, it's little things that happen. Like, remember Kirk Nogan? He couldn't score for fun. And we were playing at the Goulston. He closed down the keeper, turned his back because he was so brave, hit him on the backside, looked over the keeper and went in the net. And then he scored the next 12 games on the spin. So sometimes things like that have to happen to then put them on a run, and they can score goals. But sometimes it's got to be hit him on the back of the head or on the backside or something. And then all of a sudden, for no reason at all, they're not doing anything different in training, but they get on that goal run.
Okay, with regards to the style of play that we've got at the moment, which is very eye catching, it's very pleasing on the eye. What do you make of it? It's staggering to watch. I mean, the difference between this side and from where it was under Chris Hughton towards the end of his stay here, and obviously we've had a big turnover of players. Graham Potter's massively refreshed the team. I mean, it's from your point of view, how do you view that?
I think it's superb the way they're trying to play. At times, you look at that ball sometimes when it comes straight down the middle, and you always tell them to your players, don't play a straight ball down the middle. But, you know, they're confident in each other. They're confident to play in certain areas. And, you know, I just think in that final third, is just that more confident in that final third. And that will produce more goals for them. But it's good to watch. They want to play. They want to pass and move. They play with their heads up. And it's entertaining.
Yeah. Well, the rumour is they have actually installed a barn door for Monday.
I mean, as a manager, Martin, admittedly, you're watching as an armchair fan. You know, you happen to watch Elwin as an armchair fan at the moment. But as a manager, do you sense any issues? Do you sense any... I mean, sometimes you look at body language or you can tell about facial expressions with each other. Do you sense that it is just basically everything is largely okay apart from that one thing that we are spending our time moaning about? Or is there something that you maybe have spotted and think maybe that could happen?
No, I just think it's just that final, you know, that final third, and it will come, you know, because we always say that you defend from the front. Even though the defence has been outstanding, and Sanchez has done so well since he's come into the side. But it starts from the front, from the defending. But also the attacking third now, it's just that little split second that perhaps Malpay wants that extra touch that he didn't have to have 2 years ago or a year ago because he hasn't scored. And I think it's just, as I said to you, just once they start finding the back of their net, goals will flow. I'm sure they will.
Okay, well, let's move on to that. I'm sure we'll touch on a bit more of that later on. But let's talk about your days on the dark side of it. You were born in Reading.
Nobody else wanted me, so I
didn't. Well, you were born in Reading, but you did grow up in Croydon. You got spotted during in a Schools Cup final, I believe.
That's right.
With you and your brother. Talk to us about getting your chance.
Yeah, well, we used to live in Deal in Kent, and then we moved back up to London in 67, and I got signed at Fulham, but didn't work out, and stayed at school, and then I was playing in a game, and Palace were there, and invited me on for trial, and Touchwood, they took me on, and that was it when I was 17.
What year are we talking about here?
1969.
Oh, 69. Take that, Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Was that you and your brother were at the same time, or was there a time lapse?
He's 3 years younger.
Right.
I've got to say, he doesn't look it, but he is.
Yeah.
But those are days then when you could leave school when you was like 15.
Yeah.
And which he did. So he wasn't far behind me.
So you went to Palace as an apprentice in the days when once upon a time they were called apprentices.
That's right. Yes. We used to have to do all the nice jobs.
Yeah. Which were?
Dressing rooms, toilets.
Yeah.
Every Monday afternoon we're sweeping the stands out.
Yeah.
Which could be lucrative at times because you could find some money or whatever in the stand. But I was more on the dumper truck.
Driving that. When you did it, was the last time it was done?
When we came back to Brighton, the boys had chores to do.
Sure.
Not massive chores, but it's part of discipline. You know, that you want to be able to trust your footballers on the pitch, but also off the pitch.
I mean, obviously, the tales of apprentices of yore was always about whose boots you got to clean. So were you the scrubber for?
Stevie Kemba.
And tell us about Stevie Kemba, because it's a name I recognise, but I mean, we are talking about, you know, sadly before mine and Andy's time.
Yeah, well, Steve was captain at Palace when I did his boots, and he went on to Chelsea and Leicester.
Uh-huh.
And then he went back to Palace and was manager for a couple of times, caretaker.
Sure.
In fact, when he was manager, I was in charge of the youth team there.
Got you. Period
before Mr. Nose decided to show everybody the door. And that's when Mr. Murray came in. So that's another story.
But now, I'm going to say something slightly controversial here.
Yeah, go on.
In fact, extremely controversial. And bearing in mind who our sponsors are, I do have to say that, and I'm thinking of Crystal Palace here, 1969-70 through to about 73, is they did have some genuinely nice football first team shirts. And there was the claret with the thin, thin pale blue pinstripes. And then there was the white one with the two broad claret and blue stripes. I'm going to have to wash my mouth out with soap later. I really like them.
I'm glad you did. I didn't like them at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
How come?
You had to wear Vaseline on certain parts of your body, didn't you, for that?
Sorry, Martin, how come you didn't like them?
I just didn't like the colours in them. I liked it when we went to the red and blue stripes.
Yeah.
And then the one with the sash across the white, which a lot of clubs use now. That was when Malcolm Allison bought that shirt when we used in the cup run.
Yeah, what was that all about? Because, I mean, Palace historically were claret and blue, like West Ham, like Burnley, like Villa. They were claret and blue. Yeah. Malcolm Allison just brought in this red and blue. What was it? Do you remember that all that sort of stuff then?
Well, no, because when they, you know, they were the Glazers, their nickname was the Glazers. It's like, yeah. Right, they changed that to Eagles. I think it was just like a complete change at the club.
Sure.
You know, change the name, change the kit to a little degree. And, you know, I think that the white kit with the red and blue diagonal stripes, I think that's excellent. And then,
yeah, still that was modelled on Peru, wasn't it? And the home one.
I think Man City had that as a shirt as well.
Yeah, because Malcolm was assistant manager or first team coach at Man City, wasn't he?
Yeah.
You're very fondly remembered by Palace fans for your playing days there, had a good time in the cup run, didn't you?
Yeah, we certainly did. Yeah, it was it was the thing where we used to come down to Brighton and we stayed at Rottingdean, and we used to come down on a Sunday and we used to train at Lancing College for a couple of days. So
there's an irony.
Brighton helped us along a little bit in our cup run. We used to come down before we played Leeds and Chelsea and Sunderland, and that before.
What was the thinking about coming down to Lancing College or down to Rottingdean?
I think it was just we were a Division 3 side then, like the old Div 2 now, and I think it was just to get away from the training ground from Croydon, just somewhere quiet that we can concentrate and work on what we needed to do.
Mm-hmm. It's usually wise to get away from Croydon, but your career, you know, it was very stop start. You had a lot of problems with injuries there, and we've got to talk to you about a certain game in 1976, which you were on the sidelines for, but you were in the dressing room when a certain incident happened. That was, of course, the game that went to a third replay, as the FA Cup did in those days, at Selhurst Park. So why don't you talk us through the events of that game from your perspective?
We were absolutely outplayed from start to finish.
Oh, that really makes us feel better. Thank you.
That's a pleasure. No, I've got to be honest. You know, how we won that game, I do not know.
We do.
The man in the middle helped us a little bit, but how we got through that, you know, we were second best all over the pitch that day.
So set the scene. Palace 1-0 up. Who scored that day?
Oh, I can't remember.
I have to look it up. Okay, no worries. And it gets to the last minute, and Brighton are awarded a penalty. Now, you say it was at Stamford Bridge. They always had it as a neutral venue for the second and third replay, wherever it might be.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're in the stands watching it. Describe from your point of view, from the stands at Stamford Bridge, what happened.
There was a penalty in that, and we were just hoping that things would go our way, really. And it was probably the only thing that did go our way apart from the goal in that. But as I said, how we got through that and won that game, I do not know.
But I mean, was it encroachment? Because obviously no video evidence exists of this. And obviously Nobby had to take the penalty twice. I mean, he's told us his story, his side of it.
Yeah. As he would. No, it's just, you know, even now you've got the VAR, but you see how many times people encroach anyway.
Mm.
And they replay it for silly ideas. Everybody encroached in those days. And we just got away with it on the day, went into the next rounds. But cup games, it's all about the result.
Yeah. But how
do you remember? Sorry, do you remember Mullery doing what he did? You know, the whole legendary thing of throwing a fiver down, sticking fingers up. Did you actually see that?
Yeah, because he came to the dressing room.
Yeah.
And sort of said, like, this is what you lot are worth. And had a few words were said nicely, and you know, but that was the nature of the game. You know, it was a hard game. You do things when you're at the heat of the moment. It's weird for that, because Alan McCain then came to Brighton to Palace's manager.
Yeah, but were you aware of the simmering rivalry between Venables and Mullery?
Yeah, because it wasn't a nasty rivalry, but it was always the thing that Ben has always just did Alan at times. You know.
Mm.
And they played in the same side at Tottenham and that, and I don't think they were the best of, you know, but they were teammates. I don't think they ever went on holiday with each other, but they were teammates. But when they went into managing, when they came against each other, Ben has always just seemed to outdo Alan, you know, promotion that one year, that cup game, but he always just seemed to, you know, just have something over Alan to win things and that.
Mm.
Okay, but I mean, your career was cut short, and I mean, you're only, 25, 26 at the time. And I mean, that's a really, really young age to be given a job as a U team coach, which Terry Venables did.
It was, yeah. You know, it's a thing where when I had the injury, probably, you know, I couldn't remember the cartilage, my first cartilage. I was in hospital for 2 weeks, then in plaster. If you're not running in 2 weeks, now there's something wrong with you. So it was an injury, if it had been nowadays, would have been open and able to deal with. But I tried to make a comeback for a period, which, you know, it failed. And then Terry gave me an opportunity to coach the youth team when I was 26 years of age.
And he sent someone along to help you, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. You know, it's like anything. You learn off people all the time. And he just said to me one day at my gym, look, I've got somebody going to come in tomorrow. Do you mind? I said no, and next morning, you know, Bobby Moore walked in, and you're like, "Hey, captain of, you know, probably the best defender the world has ever seen, going to come and that." But it was an honour to work with him, but he was so different how you felt he would be. He was very quiet, you know, and he was listening to me, and I'm thinking, hold on a minute, you know, you've won the World Cup and you've played hundreds of games to West Ham in England, and you know, I wonder if he knew, but he was, you know, I did, but it was an honour, and it was a very good experience for me.
Well, I imagine it was a good experience for him as well, because I mean, he never really excelled as a manager. In fact, I think it's probably fair to say that management just wasn't for him. But, you know, I would imagine that, you know, he'd have only been sort of like a couple of years out of the game since that same Fulham FA Cup final, West Ham Fulham FA Cup final that Mullery sort of pretty much finished his career in. So, you know, admittedly, learning from a 26-year-old who's, you know, his career has been cut short, sadly. But, yeah, it's one of those head scratches. You think, no, hang on, I should be learning from you, but... Yeah. But it was something for him as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know, those things, then after that, I sort of got the three L's in football, and that was him. You look, you listen, and you learn.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that as a kid, then you're in big trouble.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, I mean, how many truly world-class players can you think of that have gone on to be outstanding managers? There's not many.
No, it's a totally different... I think people from the outside are expecting them to do well because they've done ABC in the game as a player. It doesn't always work like that. You know, it's sometimes where they go, the situation they're in. Finances is a lot now in the game. And it's been at the right place at the right time. You know, I think Rooney at Derby, I think they're not in a great position financially or in the position, but he's just gone in there and he's just gone, this is how I'm going to do it. And they're picking up results now.
Yeah, there was a brilliant corner routine. I mean, if you haven't seen it, they scored this goal from a corner a couple of weeks ago. And it was a very, very inventive routine. I've not seen it. And it was quite eye-opening.
Is it one of those where if it goes wrong, it's going to look like Keystone Cops?
I don't think so, but I mean, obviously that happens. I mean, Martin knows all about that, don't you, Martin? But we'll come to that.
That's not very nice.
Okay, but I mean, fortunately for you, you got hosed down and you came and you crossed the divide. Is it true that you rang Barry Lloyd to congratulate him on getting the Brighton job, only for him to offer the assistant gig?
Yeah, what it was, I was at Chelsea, take dinner reserves at Chelsea with John Hollins. And he got the job and I just phoned him up and wished him all the best. And apparently that afternoon, an hour or so before, he was talking about me. And he just said, look, in the summer, would you be interested in coming to join me at Brighton? He said, I don't know what role it's going to be, whether it's going to be first team, reserves or whatever. But would you be very keen and interested? I said, of course I would. And when I did come, it was, was to become first team coach with him.
Yeah. So this was 1987, wasn't it?
It was, yes. In the summer of 87. And the first day there, we drove to Portsmouth. It was wheeling and dealing a lot, Barry, those days. I think we brought 14 players in that summer. Gary Nelson, Bremner, Mike Trusson, John Kiddy, but he brought 14 odd players in and they all gelled together, which is very unusual on and off the pitch. And we had a great season, which ended up getting back promotion that first time.
Mm. Yeah, I was. I mean, I think Doug Rugarty was one of those players that came in as well, I believe, wasn't he?
Yeah, because I was taking the reserves at Chelsea and there was Doug Ruthie and Keith Dublin, who I had there.
And you just saw a dozen blokes around with Nobbo written on the front of their chest.
But that was a terrific side though as well, because I mean you had Alan Kirbishley was the linchpin in it. From the outside looking in, I was just a really really happy time watching that team that era for me. It was wonderful.
Yeah, as I said, like a manager or a coach, we went to see before we saw Alan play. We went to see him play in a reserve game at Welling. They were playing Charlton. And they lost 4-0. You know, he was 30-odd, but his attitude was still right. Even though we were losing, he wanted to play and his attitude was still right. You know, and that's why Barry signed him in the end, because he was fit what we were looking for at that time.
But I mean, that season, obviously, it culminated with that game against Bristol Rovers, where we got promotion, which is, I mean, I can clearly remember that day from start to finish.
That's the horrific story you're about to foist upon us then, AD.
Well,
apart from Kevin Bradner making his West Stand with only his underpants on.
It was Keith Dublin in his underpants I was more worried about. Yes, but yeah. It was yeah, moving swiftly on. But I mean, that team, I mean, obviously my favourite Albion player of all time, anyone who listens to this show will know, is actually Steve Penny. And he was, he didn't necessarily get on with Barry at that time, did he?
No, not say he didn't get on with him. Steve was, Northern Ireland international, he had a lot of ability. But I think Barry felt that as a team, as a unit, he didn't give us as much he was looking for. And I think John Crumpling came in there. And so it's not just that, but it's just people that, as you know and I know, that you can trust. I'm not saying couldn't trust Steve, but he just felt he needed something a little bit more from somebody in that area of the pitch.
It's interesting you mentioned this, actually, because we've had Chris Catlin on the show. It was Chris that brought him in, wasn't it? We had Chris Catlin on the show a couple of times. And AD has sort of gone all sort of into soppy mode, saying about Steve Penny this, Steve Penny that, and you can sort of just see the whole thing going into soft focus. And you can see Chris Catlin's face hardening. And he, I think with Catlin, and I don't know how you feel about this, is that with Steve Penny, he was a brilliantly talented player, but you knew that there was more to come from him. He kind of undersold himself that, he could have gone on to better things. I mean, I don't know if that was down to, and if that is the case, if that's down to considerations or if it's down to an attitude or if it's down to, just how he undersells himself. But I was just wondering, you seeing him training for the length of the time that you did while he was at the club, whether you agree with Catlin's attitude of consideration that, this was a really good player that didn't fulfil his potential.
Possibly, yeah. I think wingers are a little bit like that, aren't they? They're flattered to deceive at times,
Exactly the words Catlin used.
you've got one that's very quick and you open the gate and they run through it sort of before you can cross it. So I think those sort of areas wider, they're unpredictable, those sort of type of players.
Yeah.
Times,
Sure.
I think you're looking for somebody who perhaps may not have that ability, but get that little bit more from him and that,
Sure.
Coming up just after Shirt of the Week, obviously we're going to concentrate on the last great days of the Goldstone, or is one way of putting it, because after that playoff final, things started to go ever so slightly downhill for the Albion. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is brought to you as ever in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us another groovy shirt to have a look at here. And what can you tell us about this one, Martin? Can you describe it for me?
Yeah, it's three colours. Top half, it's a night shirt with a badge on it with an anchor on it, which is navy, mm-hmm. with a white trim across the middle with the sponsor's name.
Winn-Dixie.
And then it's like a beige colour, the rest of it. It's probably something I'll probably wear on the beach.
It doesn't look like a football shirt.
No,
it's actually a nice t-shirt in its own right. It does look like a beach t-shirt, and I think with the anchor on it, which I think Phil's photoshopped out the name of the club, but it does look like a especially as the picture is taken in front of some Louvre blinds, so it doesn't it doesn't look like a football shirt, are you sure?
Well, this is one from Phil's personal collection, which, well, I found that out. I did comment that he could have ironed it, but it was.
You're not going to let Martin guess.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to guess it. But do you want to give me an idea of what country you think it's from?
I would say South America.
Close.
All right, I'll say Central America.
Try North America. and this is your shirt of the week. This is the 2015 to 2016 home shirt of Jacksonville Armada, and they are from Florida, USA. I can't tell you what league they're in at the moment, because the lower leagues in the States are currently in a state of flux. #shambles, says Phil. Jacksonville's professional side most recently played in the NASL, which folded in 2017. In 2018, they entered the side into the amateur MPSL, which is regarded as the fourth level of soccer in the States. Since 2019, the senior side has been on a hiatus, while various factions in the US soccer continue getting nowhere agreeing a finalized format for the leagues across the country. Just sort it out. Jacksonville Armada play at the 12,000 capacity Hodges Stadium, which is a multi-sport venue. The team are nicknamed the Boys in Blue for no apparent reason that he can deduce. There's not a lot of history for the Boys in Blue. The team was formed in 2013 with aspirations of ascending one day to the MLS. In their first season, they recruited Boca Juniors legend Jose Luis Villarreal as head coach. And in their first competitive match, they beat FC Edmonton 3-1. In 2017, they had their best showing in the NASL, finishing fifth. The club is looking to vent to the future with plans to build a soccer-specific stadium and re-enter whatever league they're allowed to once this pandemic is over. A link to the UK, gentleman Jamal Johnson, who played for, amongst others, Blackburn, Preston, Wolves, Leicester, Leeds, Preston, and most notably 96 times for Milton Keynes. He played for Jacksonville between 74 times between 2015 and 17. Link to the Albion, of course, there's one. I think he was there while you were there, actually, Martin. Tony Miola played for the Albion 11 times in goal in 1990, and he took over as head coach of Jacksonville between 2015 to 2016 when they came fifth in the NASL. Thanks, Phil.
Well, can you draw breath now?
Yeah. I'm just trying to get...
It's kind of interesting. I mean, since we got promoted to the Premier League 4 years ago, obviously what we do is we harvest a bunch of new fans worldwide because they're interested in the Premier League. They're not interested in the Championship. And so we get arbitrary fans who will, a bit like, I suppose, fans over here, who will just pick and choose an NFL side or a baseball side without any rhyme or reason to it because they like the name, they like a big given player, they like the badge, whatever it might be. Yeah. So the same here. And there's a good friend of mine, Laura Ellen. She's from Pittsburgh, and her team, the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. Now they're in the NASL, and if they get promoted, provided they have the infrastructure, they can go to the MLS. But they're playing in a 10,000-seater stadium. So for all the glitz and glam that you used to have with the old 70s North American Soccer League, with George Best and Rodney Marsh and Franz Beckenbauer and what have you, it's nothing like it used to be. So if you've got Jacksonville, which is a major city in Florida, wants to build its own, you know, bespoke stadium, they're probably not going to need something that's more than 15,000, which is something that, you know, Wimbledon or York or something like that have just built.
Well, who knows? I mean, the States, I mean, it's constantly growing. I mean, there's talk of them actually starting a cricket league in America next year. And there's talk that they finally cottoned on that the two biggest sports in the world are football, hashtag soccer, and cricket, and they don't play any of them. So they're trying to get with the times.
Well, they do play rugby. Did you know the world's first cricket test match was actually played between the USA and Canada? It's true.
Well, there you go. Anyway, moving swiftly on to what I am calling the last great days of the Goldstone before, well, we all know what happened, don't we? Yeah, but I mean it was almost like a final hurrah that season, wasn't it? With us getting to the playoff final. I mean, that was a great season. Probably the only team ever to get to the playoff final with a minus goal difference.
What do you remember about that in those days, then, Martin? The run to Wembley.
Yeah, it was. I think we, like, at the end, it was just we got in the last game or so to get into the bottom. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we had a minus goal difference, which means I think we were quite an attacking side at those days.
Yeah. Oldham sticking six passes didn't help.
No. We try to remember Oldham.
Yeah. That's what I said.
We never did well at Oldham. It was always raining and horrible and wet and windy.
Yeah.
So we didn't like going there. But no, it was just getting to the playoff was massive plus for the football club. And then we had Millwall at home in the first leg. And, you know, after going 1-0 down and ending up 4-1, I think it was probably the best we played, I think, all that season, especially in the second half, and managing to get through to the final. And once we got to the final, and you want to go and play well, and we just let ourselves down on the day, unfortunately. And
I blame the kit.
Yeah. You don't change your kit for the final, do you? Put a new one on.
Martin, who came up with that? Come on, you were part of the inner circle. Who came up with that?
I've got to say, probably Barry Lloyd. A lot of it was. Remember the blue and white kit with the stripes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Well, they used to have that as a training short at Chelsea when Barry was there playing, and that's how they got the shorts out. But they sold more shorts than anything because of the thing that remember they had the club shop, didn't they?
You come out
the station. Walked down towards the beach, and there was a little club shop on the left.
Next to the Chinese takeaway, yeah.
And they didn't know that. And people used to go in there and buy the blokes,
the clock tower, Al.
Yeah, but.
I thought you were talking Hove Railway Station. Sorry. Railway Station. Right. Sorry.
They sold so many pairs of shorts in the summer, and people were wearing them on the beach.
Yeah.
this is the Andy Pandy kit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tesco's on it now.
Carry a bag, Andy Pandy. Someone said 11. I mean, I'm just thinking of the Perry Digweed look of green shirts, stripy shorts, and leggings. Let's not go that bit. But I mean, as a look, I mean, it's only Perry Digweed could pull that off.
Yeah, but that run to the final. I mean, we had some great players in that team. The likes of John Byrne, Clive Walker. Was that a link to Chelsea with you there?
Barry brought Clive in. John Byrne, Mike Small, John Robinson was there. Clive was so much. Gary Chivers. You know, they were good characters. And they were not only good on the pitch, but they were excellent off it. You know, you smile every day when you go into training. And they were good players. They were coming towards the end of their career to a degree, but they still had that quality.
But one player that wasn't involved in that final and was often was quite bitter about not being able to play at Wembley was Gary Nelson. So what can you tell us about that particular story?
Well, I think Gary got injured. And it's like you pick what you think. You know, John Byrne had a dead cartilage just before that. And he struggled to be fit for it. And to be fair, we did change our shape. We did play three at the back. Perhaps looking at it now, we shouldn't have done. But we had our shape like that, and that's how we were going to play. So you kind of, you know, as a manager, you live or die by the sword, don't you? You pick the side that you think is going to win the game.
Okay, well let's move on. We've got to ask you about Bill Archer.
Don't forget last week we had Malcolm Steele on, and you can still pick that up on our show. And you were saying just before we came on in, Martin, that you enjoyed listening to Malcolm's tales and to check their truthfulness, their veracity, and I think also to work out how many were going to be about you. But could you tell us the first time you remember meeting Messrs. Archer, Bellotti and Stanley? I mean, did they have that much of an impact for you, or were they just there just as much as you're still going to tread in dog muck no matter how much you're going to try and avoid it?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult for the club financially and that because, you know, we got to say the playoff 91 and we were 90 minutes ago into the best league in the world. It didn't happen. And then that summer, we had to sell our best players. Because of the financial side of it. Mm-hmm. And they came in as financial people, not football people. And it was very hard to deal with, you know?
But, I mean, you're saying that they're as financial people, but, I mean, you know, certainly I mean, Malcolm's not backwards in coming forwards, and it's okay, two of them are dead, so you can say what you want. I think he now looks back on it rather than worrying about it then, but he now looks back on it as thinking that was a horrible time to be working at a football club that you actually have a certain affinity to. Is that how you felt?
It was a bit, because there was a period that we didn't get paid for 6 months.
Oh, wow. 6 months?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And the players got paid because of the PFA, etc. Uh-huh. But the staff never did. And so not to get paid, you know, you might go in. There was a lad there, Fred, who used to do the lottery. And we used to wind him up. You got any cash today, Fred, for us, you know? And he'd end up giving us a couple of, you know, we get a couple of £100 on a Friday.
Oh, really?
So it was the quality of the staff, like Malcolm, Larry May and Barry, that kept the club going to a degree, because the players were still, like, they were finding it hard and not getting paid on time at times, but they've got a bit with the PFA. But the staff at the club, not just the footballing staff, but the people in the offices never got paid on time. And it just showed the loyalty to the football club.
Okay. Well, I mean, that whole story's been well documented, and like, obviously, it's a very, very important part of our history. But
what it was for you though, Martin. First, I mean, you said what it's like for the staff, but you personally, you know, let's say professionally, you can't get on with your job, but you personally, you just think, I don't want this anymore.
You do and you don't, because I love the game. And I always will. And to be honest, the first time I got paid on time, I got the sack 2 weeks later. I probably shouldn't have got paid on.
Okay, well, let's just move it on from there, because, I mean, obviously, like I said, it's a very important time of our history, and it can never be forgotten. But we've got to talk about the knight in shining armour that came in to rescue the club, and that is, of course, Dick Knight. And you had a very good relationship with Dick, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, I came back in 1998, Brian Horton was manager. I just left Portsmouth, and he said, look, we'd like you to come in and we want to get the youth set up going again. And I said, what, youth team coach? And he went, no, you're too old. I went, thanks very much.
Yeah, quite.
I said, I'm still younger than you. But, you know, you've got Dean Wilkins in there as youth team coach. And we had a 5-year plan that the club financially couldn't go out and get players in. Now, we wanted to try and get homegrown players into the football club. When we first went there, we were still playing at Gillingham. So it was still hard. But when we come back into with Dean, even though it was with Dean, the football club was back in the city. And that's what we needed. And Dick was a major person in dealing with that and getting the club back into the city, where we could then have some pride in our football club.
Yeah, I mean, Nobby says he would have stayed if we were still in Brighton, but it was just too much going to Gillingham.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went to Gillingham, it was an evening game. It was an 8 o'clock kickoff. The game finished. We spoke to Nobby afterwards. I got home at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm thinking,
this is from a home game.
This is a home game.
Yeah.
Got back to Selsey at 2 o'clock and think, blimey. And supporters were going up there, you know, to watch the games and that and things like that. And you can only give him so much credit for being so loyal and loving the club.
But I mean, you were such a crucial part in the development of the players. And obviously you've, we're going to talk about Lewis Dunk in a minute, but you're working with Mickey Adams as well. And we got back to Brighton. We're out with Dean, which is not the ideal situation, but we always like to hear what your, players and coaches opinion of our ramshackle home were.
Yes, it was, just say, it wasn't ideal. You know, I remember going years and years before that to watch my son athletics, and it was still the same then. Yeah. But they did the best, the directors and Dick did the best they could at the time, trying to make it better as a football club, but it was never going to be a football ground. I used to hate going there, to be honest, but to watch it, and I think the players did as well. But the biggest thing was it was back in the city. And that was the first step. We had to get back there first. And if it meant going to with Dean for a period of time, then so be it. So, you know, it took a while to get the new stadium.
Winning divisions must have helped, though.
Well, it does, yeah. Of course, winning games of football does matter. to be fair to Dickie, got the right managers in at the right time. Yeah. Perhaps at set one. but no doubt you'll come on to that in a minute. But you know, we had people there that perhaps had a point to prove as managers or up and coming in their careers, and they've got players in that really, you know, worked hard for the football club.
Yeah. But some of that, obviously, because of the situation, we had to bring through our own players, and you were very crucial in the development of those. And I mean, I think I haven't got a full list of all the players, but I believe it's that 31 players that you coach went on to play for the first team. That's impressive.
31?
Yeah. 31.
I think it was a bit more than that, but we're not going to. But the thing was, it wasn't just better. Me. It was the people working at the centre. It was the centre of excellence there, and it's academy now. And it was the people working there, firstly for peanuts, you know, two or three times a week, Saturdays and Sundays, working with the boys. So it was a team effort. All right, people say, well, you were in charge of it, but the people with me made it so easy for me working those times. But you know, we looked at. Remember me and Dean sitting there when we got the job, saying, wouldn't it be nice to have ambition or a dream to have 11 players out there that come from Brighton.
You got close.
We got to eight one day.
We did. But don't you think you're being a little bit sort of overtly modest here though, Martin? Because like I say, I mean, you were, it's not just the fact that, you know, this happened. I think it was also about the fact that we as fans could see that it was happening and therefore, you know, are appreciative of it. Anything that we know as fans is down to X, Y, Z because of this, this, and this. I mean, anything we don't know, we can't sort of like, you know, make a judgment on it, but we knew that actually so much of this was down to you. So if you don't mind me saying, I think you've been a tad modest there.
No, I was just to say, you know, football's a team game. There's no I in team. So
there is me.
No, it was just good to work at that time with the kids and see them develop. You know, from a young age that they came from, some of them came from under nines and ended up playing in the first team.
Absolutely.
Well, it's funny as you say under nines, but we're gonna talk about that in a sec. But I mean, you did get given the top job yourself. Any regrets?
No. It's a job where if you've been in coaching all your life and an opportunity comes along to manage a club that you love and enjoy working with and that, you're not gonna say no, are you? You know, it's a thing where it was probably the wrong time. You know, like we just got promotion. We were a little bit late appointing the manager. Financially, we were not well off. We had one player that had played in the championship and the rest hadn't played at that level before. So when it comes along, you're not going to say, no, I don't want it. I'll wait a couple of years. You take it and you try and do your best. And I wouldn't change it again. I wouldn't change it if it happened tomorrow. I'd go, I'll do it. And the same thing might happen. But what I tried to do was try to bring players in that I knew the younger players that would benefit a period of time in the football team and go on to have a good careers. Yeah. I never saw it as a manager, but there we are.
I mean, the likes of Tommy Elphick and Dean Hammond. I mean, Dean Hammond went on to play in the Premier League and win. He's got a Premier League winner's medal.
Yeah. You know, there was him, Adam Virgo, Dan Harding. Mm-hmm. You know, there was people there that, Adam Hinch, my nephew, that ended up having good careers at the game. But it was a learning curve.
Dean Cox is still playing, isn't he?
Yeah, the little, only saw him, but I shouldn't. But no, he's still playing at Scarborough.
I mean, Russell Slade used to call him his little ball of anger management.
Yeah. Given your 20-plus year association with the Albion, I think it's, you know, when we said about you coming on the show, we talk about the good times and the bad and what have you. I think it's, and I don't think anyone does, to be honest, I think it's catastrophically unfair to judge your time at the Albion with those 12, 14 games that you were in charge. Like I say, you being appointed was not done in the best of circumstances. You know, it was done with about 5 minutes before the start of the season. You lost Bobby Zamora for most of it. It was you know, a huge sea change for what was going on. And I think that actually the fact that then Dick possibly realizing that, okay, it wasn't working, but it's also catastrophically unfair to say, right, I'm going to have to relieve you of your duties. You're out of the club. That he actually sort of said, no, you're going to stick around because, you know, because usually the manager is the last job that someone has with a football club. Not always, but usually. I'm glad for, hopefully for you, but certainly for the football club, that Dick retained your services.
Yeah, I think the good thing was I didn't appoint anybody to take my job. I left it open. But apparently, you know, it was quite funny those days because I used to still watch some trainer kids and they sort of said, well, you're probably the only manager in the football league that knows every kid that is in a youth setup. But, you know, when Steve came along, he was excellent, Steve Coppell. You know, he said, have a couple of days to think about what you want to do. And, you know, but we want you to set a football club. And he was the reason why, you know, at the time I was hurting, because you're always hurting when things don't go well for you. But I was so pleased that he believed and Dick believed that I still could do a job, you know, with the youth set up. And that's why I stayed.
Good.
We're absolutely delighted about it because, I mean, we're currently reaping the benefits of that with one particular player that you brought to the club as a 9-year-old after his dad didn't want to drive to Wimbledon anymore. And basically, it's a long and short of it.
You tell the story then, Martin.
Yeah, well, what happened was when I came in, I knew most of Lewis's friends were all playing and we'd signed most of them. But Lewis was at Wimbledon and MK then... They went up to MK Dons, and they had to release all their players under 14. And so we were in there straight away. He did go up to Palace for a while. So I do apologise for saying that name. I did persuade him that his future was at Brighton, and to his dad was travelling, and he signed as an under when he was under 12, under 11, and. The rest is history. He's just pushed on. And as I say, he's making an excellent captain of the club. And how he doesn't get in the England squad, I do not know.
When you first clapped eyes on him and sort of started nurturing him as a footballer, did you have any inkling as to how far he would or could go?
Well, every kid you have in, you want the best for him. I can remember when Steve Brown came in as youth team coach. Mm-hmm. And he comes in and he said, these are the ones to watch. And Dunkey, I said, well, he's the best one you're going to have. He's going to go all the way. And he'd been out injured for a while. And he came back in and I've got to say, he was like Bambi on ice. He was awful. And Brandy looked at me and said, you sure? once he played games, and after about 2 months, he went, you're going to be right. He's going to captain this football club. You have players like that who need to play week in and week out. Dunkey, when he was younger, if he missed a couple of games, it took him, you know, 3 or 4 games to get back to that level of consistency again.
Sure. Okay, so Lewis was a player you can't quite work out why he hasn't gone on to play for England, but we have got a few others in the team at the moment, which apparently look like they may have leapfrogged him in the pecking order, according to Gareth Southgate. So what do you make of the prospects of Ben White and Adam Webster making the step up to a white shirt?
Yeah, possibly. Ben, I would think Ben has been excellent. You know, I think what's helped him is it's, he came from Southampton, then he's under 16 after they released him. And I think what's him in good stead, he went out on loan very early because playing under 23 football at times is a waste of time. But he went out a year at Newport, then went up to the next level at Peterborough and then the next level at Leeds. So for the last 3 years before now, he's been out playing men's football where it matters, getting beat up at times in the lower leagues. But he always showed that he's got so much ability and he can play, as he's done for Brighton at the moment, in several areas of the pitch. And as I saw today that apparently Leeds turned offered 30 million for him. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not the biggest as Lewis or Adam, but he does compete in the air, but he's very aware and he's comfortable on the ball. As I say, he can play at the back, he can play as a wing back, right back, even as a holding midfield player, which he did at Leeds when I watched him a couple of times.
If you're his manager, Martin, and bearing in mind you've seen him on the telly, sort of, you know, in those various roles, a little bit of gun to head maybe for you, but if you were his manager, where would you say, in your opinion, you feel that his most accomplished role is within those positions he's played?
Well, people probably say that, is he big enough to be a centre-half? You know, that's what the first thing, because if you put him alongside Lewis, Burnie and Webster, he's a midget.
everyone's a midget next to Dan Bird, frankly.
What I mean? But I liked him. I watched, when I was at Stoke, I watched him a few times because we were looking at him as, you know, perhaps to get on loan and things. And I saw him play a couple of games as a holding midfield player, doing a marking job. Mm-hmm. And he was outstanding. I can remember him at Hull playing it. But what he did do then, when they got possession, he was capable of breaking out and getting forward up on the ball as well. So I quite like him as a holding midfield player, doing a defensive job. But as I say, you know, I do like him as a centre-half. But I think he's one of those that I think it'll take him another year, 18 months before we find his real position.
I mean, people forget, I think, that he's actually only sort of still, you know, a couple of dozen games into his Premier League career, isn't he?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've read an interview that you did recently where you were so full of praise for the stewardship of Tony Bloom. And, you know, I mean, and the fact that, you know, the investment that he's actually put into the club. And it basically means that we don't actually have to sell our best players.
No, certainly not. You know, I think those days are gone. You know, everybody's got a price, haven't they? You know, they were talking about Lewis in the summer, 40 million. That's a lot of money to a club like Brighton, where, especially at the moment with the COVID and that, but the chairman is stuck by his guns and he's not going to let people go out of that football club who he knows will hopefully push the club forward over the next couple of seasons.
Okay. Well, the other players that have come through the academy that you coached that have gone on to have a professional career, not necessarily at Brighton, which other ones are you really, really proud of? I mean, I'm sure you're proud of all of them, but...
Yeah, even now, some boys that didn't quite make it, I see playing non-league football. I always see them and, you know, and they're still doing all the things we did when they were younger. So that's pleasing that they're still trying to do the things that they were taught at an early age. I think Solly March, unfortunately now he's got this injury, I think it's probably the best he's been playing this last season. And he came into the game, into the football club a little bit later than the others.
Probably under one you. Of the best.
Sorry?
Under you?
Yeah, he was at St. Bede's. And he was connected with Lewis as well. And we went to watch him about three or four times at St. Bede's. And then we took him in from St. Bede's while he was from there. Because his dad was an apprentice when Barry Lloyd was manager.
Oh, right.
Going back all those years. And he was a winger as well.
Fair enough.
He was a winger as well from Helsham.
Yeah. Here's a quiz question for you then, Martin.
Well, no.
Who is Solly March's agent?
Robert Codner.
Yes, it is.
It's because Martin listens to the Albion Roar, isn't he? It must be.
Yeah, I've had a few conversations with Robert, not just about Solly, but other people as well. And, you know, I was working at other clubs, but it was nice that they found out and asked what you feel as well, how he's performing and that in games.
But it is indicative of something that in the past 20 years, and probably you yourself have actually sort of helped to unearth it, but in the past 20, 30 years, has been a greater increase in professional footballers from Sussex, or, you know, who've actually gone on to have a career, where previously, I don't know, prior to the 70s, you know, there was only one Sussex-born player before, I think I'm probably about 1995, one Sussex-born player between the war and the end of the century that had played for England.
Yeah.
Bobby Tamblyn. And he was born in Storrington and had nothing to do with the Albion. But, you know, it's something now that, I want to say we're not quite a hotbed of football, but, you know, you've unearthed or you've started the process of unearthing an awful lot of talent around Sussex that was other, you know, hitherto untapped.
Yeah, as I say, it's they don't just come out. You need the people to go out on the ground to look at them for you now. You know, I know I was talking about earlier about people working around me. At one stage at Brighton, I had 20 part-time scouts. And they would go out Saturday and Sunday watching games. And they never got paid. All they got was a handing-me-down coat from the year before that the subs is winning. And they were quite happy to do it because they liked working for the football club. They were Sussex people. Yeah. And they wanted the football club to do well. It's just getting out. The players are out there. You know, all right, the better ones are going to cost a lot of money, but there are a lot of players out there now that need to, you know, can be seen and can come into the football club.
Now, you've been on here on this show now for about the past hour of the last hour and 10 minutes or so, hour and 20, talking about Brighton rather than Palace. But, I mean, given your background and given your family and yourself and what have you, here's the most unfair question. Martin, are you Palace or Brighton?
It depends where I am.
Okay. Well, I'm real politician's answer. You did get on with David Bellotti, didn't you?
On Monday, when the game's on, and my grandsons and my son will be watching it, I'll be Palace.
Right.
Only because I like winding them up.
It's time to move. Let's talk about this game on Monday and your experiences of the games from both sides of it and the rivalry, of course. Because you've been involved in, well, unfortunately, it ended up in two defeats for the Albion. But I've read in dispatches of your reaction to both of them. If I say the name Calvin Morton to you,
I was there. Who was it that got sent off? Was it Trussum?
Mark Trussum got sent off early in the first half. Yeah. He could never tackle him. And it was an unbelievable afternoon of football. You couldn't have written that, couldn't you?
No.
You know, they missed four.
Yeah.
We got the one. And now we didn't win, get sent out of the game, even with 10 men. It was unbelievable.
But it was, I mean, everyone talks about this game of the mad, of five penalties in the one game. Let's just bottle that down a little bit. It was five penalties in 27 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he just went mad, didn't he?
Oh, I imagine supporters standing watching it, but sitting there watching it aside, it was just unbelievable.
But it has got. I mean,
the thing is, AD, in those days, the away fans were in the you entered by in the corner bit on the Holmesdale Road. So when on the telly, you're at the left hand end, but in the corner, it was a big terrace in those days.
Yeah.
And every time the ball just got crossed into the box, I just remember the Albion fans, shouting penalty, penalty, and lo and behold, along came another penalty.
It was. I don't think their record's actually been beaten since, and that was
been matched, but not beaten.
Certainly not in 27 minutes. But on another one that I've read about was. It was shortly after you lost the top job, but you were still involved under Steve Coppell. And apparently you were absolutely livid. There's another game where we always seem to have a player sent off at Selhurst. I don't know what it is. Yeah. I mean, Dunkey twice, but it was.
Just before Martin answers that, do you know who the last Palace player to be sent off against Brighton was? Henry Houghton.
Really? It should have been Zaha about six times, but it was...
no. Sorry, yeah. So what was your memories of that 5-0 game that we still haven't lived down?
Oh, I was on... Because Steve was in charge. Stevie Cropp was... it's like when I got the manager's job, that was probably the first game I looked for, the fixtures.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I got the sack just before that, but there we are. But I was going mad. I've got to be honest, and sort of Steve's told me not to say anything because I just wanted to rip a few heads off.
What, of Brighton players?
Yeah, because the way we'd played on the day, we didn't compete enough, we didn't work hard enough. And if you get beat by doing that, you can't complain.
Yeah.
If you feel as though we haven't, worked hard enough to get a result, then it hurts.
So we were lucky to get nil.
Yeah.
It's the thing I said afterwards. I said, the trouble is, by 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, you would have forgotten about this, but I'll be still thinking about it Monday morning. No, as I say, even though I was, as you said, I was at Palace, that hurt. getting beat by them. And it was hard to take.
I mean, we had Paul Rodgers on the show a while ago, and he tells a story of like when he was brought on as a sub on that game, and we were already 5-0 down, and Steve Coppell turned around to him and said, "Don't let this get out of hand."
I think you might have had a couple of other choice words for him, wouldn't you?
But I mean, let's be on the going to onto the positive, because you've been involved in a few wins as well. Pick your favourite.
Boxing Day.
That narrows it down.
I was looking it all up the other day, and it was Boxing Day at the Goulston.
Yeah.
It must have been the first time I was there. I can't think of the year it was, but we were excellent on that day.
Is that when we won 2-0? 2-0.
Boxing
Day 87 or 86?
86, 87, my first went there with Barry.
Okay, well, hang on. Boxing Day 86-87, we lost 2-0 at Crystal Palace.
That was one.
And then there was Easter Monday, we won 2-0 at home.
It might have been the Easter Monday game then.
Yeah, at the Goldstone.
Yeah.
Can you remember the scorers?
No, but you're going to tell me, aren't you?
I am, because I happen to have Tim Carter's book to hand here. It was Danny Wilson and Darren Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, obviously, this is a much misunderstood rivalry in certain quarters. But what do you make of it? Do you understand it? I mean, obviously, you're doing part of it from both sides.
Oh yeah, I understand it. You know, it's. I think it's great. You know, I think it's, you know, it's not a local derby, but I think it, the way over the years it's progressed and that. I think it's both sets of fans look forward to it more than anything. I think it sums up a little bit, if you don't mind just going off here, that I can remember my brother playing for England when Woolley scored. Was it 4 at the Goldstone?
Oh, the 121s.
Yep.
6-0 at the
Goldstone. Yep. And I was coming up from New Zealand. I played in the QPR and I drove down to watch the game.
Yeah.
Every time my brother touched a ball playing right back for England, he got booed.
Oh, really?
And it wasn't his performance. It was just who he came, where he was.
Because he came from Crystal Palace. But therein lies the irony, isn't it? I mean, I've done a couple of social media films and a couple of bits and pieces about this Palace-Brighton rivalry. And yeah, it is a rivalry rather than this sort of like, prelude to war, because there is this Christmas Day truce that we have when it's not COVID, but there is this Christmas Day truce we have with the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund match. And it is a genuine, I really do feel it's a genuine celebration of football and football rivalry in the friendliest terms.
Yeah, certainly. You know, when that came out for the first time, you think that's not going to work, but you know, it's been unbelievable over the years and the money they've raised and that. And it just shows that two clubs can be one. When they need to.
Which does make a sort of cynic think, well, hang on, is this rivalry all just chutzpah then?
No, I think it is a rivalry. You know, to say, I can remember, you know, when I was working with Barry and Brighton and that, when we did play those, I wanted to beat them, you know, because I was not just I was employed by Brighton, but that's what we wanted to win games of football.
Well, I would like to point out, Martin, that you've now lived in Sussex for longer than you ever lived in Croydon. So, I mean, come on. I think come Monday night, I think we all know which side your bread's buttered. Come on. Yeah. So, with that is all we've got time for. So, thank you so much to everyone for listening. Thank you to Alan Wes. Thank you so much to Martin Hinshelwood. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We'll be back next week, hopefully celebrating massive 3 points against Crystal Palace. Thanks for listening. See you then. Bye.